Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Highlights from the American Society of Clinical Oncology ASCO Annual Meeting, Driving Knowledge to Action, Building a Better Future. And this is part one of a two-part series. And we have actually seven speakers on today's program, so I want you to all be aware. They're each going to cover a different type of cancer. And today's program has been made possible, supported by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Novartis Oncology, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, before I actually introduce our first speaker, I just want to mention to all of you that we have over 125 participants on the call today live, and many of you will be listening to the podcast of the program that will go up in about a week and will stay up for at least a year, if not longer. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And we will send you that information when the call is available as a podcast as well. But you're all on the program today live. And we have participants from all over the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Argentina, Canada, St. Lucia, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. This is truly a global call. And it's a credit to each of you that you chose to spend this next hour with us. Now, it is my great pleasure now to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Kamal Abu Hussein. And Dr. Hussein is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Cooper Medical School of Rowan University, Adjunct Assistant Professor, Department of Breast Medical Oncology, MD Anderson Cancer Center, Co-Director of the Janet Knowles Breast Cancer Program, Director of Breast Cancer Clinical Trials, MD Anderson Cancer Center at Cooper. And Dr. Hussein will be addressing what occurs at the ASCO meeting and breast cancer updates from ASCO. It is my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hussein.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you so much for the kind presentation. I'm very pleased to be here with all of you today and hopefully share some of the most exciting breast cancer research updates from the 2025 ASCO annual meeting. Now, every year, thousands of cancer doctors, researchers, and patient advocates from around the world gather at the ASCO annual meeting, and this is considered the largest and most important cancer conference in the world. So it's a place where experts share the latest breakthroughs in cancer research, treatment, and care. And for people with breast cancer and any type of cancer, really, I want you to know that at ASCO, every year after the meeting, we come up with conclusions about possible new treatments that are introduced that may soon become available, or are already changing the way the cancer care is being delivered. We review the latest results of clinical trials that help us as physicians understand what works best for our patients and who does it work for and why. New ways to monitor our patients with their cancer treatment, predicting response to treatment using some of the advanced testing like circulating tumor DNA and others, and also focus on patient-centered approaches that are being discussed at that conference that are always geared towards reducing side effects while keeping treatments effective. So in short, ASCO is where tomorrow's cancer care begins. And today we'll walk through some of the important updates in several areas, from new treatment options in the metastatic breast cancer setting to personalized monitoring with blood-based testing and new strategies to reduce side effects and improve quality of life. So first, I want to focus on the HER2-positive metastatic breast cancer. We reviewed the results of the DESTINY-Breast09 trial, which may lead to a big shift in how we treat patients right from the beginning. In this study, they tested a drug called Enhertu, also known as trastuzumab deruxtecan. This belongs to the class of drugs called antibody-drug conjugates. And that was combined with an antibody against the HER2 protein called Perjeta or pertuzumab. And it compared it to the current standard approach using a combination of antibodies against the HER2 protein and chemotherapy. And what they found was a remarkable improvement in patients who received the Enhertu plus pertuzumab that ended up living nearly 14 months longer without their cancer getting worse or progressing compared to those on the older standard of care. This is the first major improvement in over a decade for people with HER2-positive metastatic disease as a first line. And this also offers a possibility of a less traditional chemotherapy upfront, for which hopefully that means a better quality of life from the beginning. Now, to triple-negative breast cancer, which we know that this is a more aggressive, many times harder to treat type of breast cancer, we reviewed the results of the ASCENT-04 clinical trial. And here, researchers looked at the combination of Trodelvy, that is another antibody-drug conjugate, also known as sacituzumab govitecan. So basically, it is a drug that links itself to the chemotherapy, or links the chemotherapy really to an antibody that is expressed on the surface of the cancer cell, along with an immunotherapy called Keytruda. This is in patients who had PD-L1 positive disease, which is a marker that typically portends a likelihood of response to immune-based therapy in breast cancer. This combination of the two drugs reduced the risk of progression or death by 35% compared to the standard of care chemotherapy and Keytruda. And just as importantly, it allowed more patients to stay on treatment with fewer interruptions, suggesting that it may be both more effective and more manageable in terms of side effects. So this is a hopeful option for patients starting first-line therapy for advanced triple-negative breast cancer. Now let's turn to patients with hormone receptor-positive HER2-negative breast cancer that has become resistant to hormonal therapy. Really, two studies stood out. The first one was the VERITAC-2 trial, which introduced a new drug called vepdegestrant, which helps destroy the estrogen receptor when it mutates, something that often causes treatment resistance. So in this study, patients lived more than twice as long without disease progression compared to the older standard of care, fulvestrant, and the response rate jumped from 4 to 19%. And this shows that targeting the ESR1 mutations, which is mutations in the estrogen receptor, more directly may be a key to overcoming resistance and hopefully improving response and improving the progression-free survival for those patients. Next, we also reviewed the INAVO 120 trial that looked at patients whose tumors had a mutation called PIK3CA. This is another driver of resistance to cancer treatment, and it's present in a good number of our patients, up to 40%. And when they added this new drug called inavolisib to the standard combination of Ibrance and fulvestrant, patients lived about 7 months longer overall. They were also able to delay chemotherapy by nearly 2 years. For many, that means more time living with better quality of life. Now let's talk about circulating tumor DNA, also referred to as ctDNA. This is a blood-based test that looks for tiny fragments of cancer DNA in the bloodstream. It is sometimes called a liquid biopsy, and it's one of the most promising tools in personalized cancer care. For that, they presented the SERENA-6 trial that showed that ctDNA can detect resistance before it shows up on the radiographic scans. And for patients with hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, the researchers were able to spot this new ESR1 mutation in real time and switch to a drug called camizestrant early on. And potentially when they did that, they are beating the cancer to the punch before it grows. Another trial was a PREDICT-DNA study that looked at early stage triple-negative breast cancer and HER2-positive breast cancer patients. And surprisingly, they found that patients who had no ctDNA in their blood before surgery had a great prognosis, even if they didn't have a complete response to chemotherapy. And this suggests that ctDNA might be a more accurate way to predict long-term outcomes than traditional measures. And finally, the DARE trial. This followed high-risk hormone receptor-positive patients using ctDNA during treatment, and those who did not have ctDNA present had a 99% relapse-free survival rate over 2 years. And to me, that is powerful. It means this blood test may soon help us tailor follow-up and treatment intensity for each person based on their real-time risk. Next, I would like to focus on several studies that focus on how we give treatments, not just what we give. First one is the TAM-01 trial that looked at very low doses of tamoxifen, that including just a 1 milligram a day of tamoxifen. And I would like to point out that the standard dosage for tamoxifen is 20 milligrams on a daily basis. So you can appreciate what a small dose that is. So they use this in women at high risk of developing breast cancer, and even at these tiny doses, the drug significantly reduced the risk of invasive breast cancer, with only a small increase in hot flashes and fewer other side effects. Meanwhile, the TRADE trial tested slow increase in the dosage of a drug called abemaciclib or Verzenio, and that is used in early-stage hormone receptor-positive breast cancer. And starting low helped more than 90% of the patients stay on treatment, and over 70% reached the full dosage without needing to stop. And these findings show that gentler starts and lower doses may help people stay on life-saving medications longer and with fewer interruptions. We also saw some promising updates for early stage disease. So in the NeoStar trial, researchers tested Trodelvy. Again, that's an antibody drug conjugate, and Keytruda, which is already a combination that's already tested and found to be effective for metastatic triple negative in patients before surgery for early stage disease. And about 1 in 3 patients had no detectable cancer left at surgery. A strong early signal that this combination may benefit earlier stage triple-negative breast cancer. Of course, more studies are needed to refine this approach, but it's a step forward in using newer treatment earlier. And finally, they presented the long-term follow-up from the SOFT and TEXT trials that showed that younger women with hormone-sensitive breast cancer benefited significantly from ovarian suppression, plus an aromatase inhibitor called aromasin. It reduced the recurrence rates and improved survival, especially in those at high risk. So this reinforces the importance of personalized strategies for premenopausal women who often face unique challenges during treatment. So to wrap up, the updates from this year's ASCO meeting are encouraging for anyone affected by breast cancer. We are seeing longer survival, more time between treatments in metastatic disease, better options for triple-negative and hormone-resistant cancers, smarter and more personalized monitoring with circulating tumor DNA, and a kinder dosing approach that supports quality of life. Most of all, we're seeing real progress across every stage of breast cancer, from early detection to advanced disease. Thank you so much for being patient, and I will pass it back to Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hussain. That was a superb presentation, really stellar. And you really have captured so much information in such a brief amount of time from the ASCO meeting on breast cancer. Thank you so much. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jeffrey Bruce. And Dr. Bruce is the Edgar M. Hausepian Professor of Neurological Surgery, Vice Chairman of Academic Affairs, New York Presbyterian Columbia University Medical Center, Director Bartoli Brain Tumor Research Laboratory, Co-Director Brain Tumor Center. And Dr. Bruce will be addressing brain tumor updates from ASCO and quality of life updates from ASCO. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Bruce.
Thank you, Carolyn, and hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Whether you're a patient, caregiver, survivor, or simply someone who cares deeply about the fight against brain cancer, I'm honored to speak with you today. I also want to thank Anthony Tang, one of my medical students, who helped put this talk together. We're here to share something powerful, hope, grounded in real, meaningful progress. At the ASCO annual meeting, one of the largest and most respected cancer conferences in the world, several new advances in brain tumor therapy were presented that could change lives. I want to walk you through the highlights in clear, plain language and explain what they might mean for you or your loved ones. Let's start with one of the most exciting areas of research, immunotherapy, treatments that help your own immune system recognize and fight cancer. Our immune system has a hard time detecting brain tumors, in part because the brain is protected by its own immune environment. But scientists are finding ways to overcome that. One of the most promising examples is known as CAR T-cell therapy. This is a personalized treatment where a patient's own immune cells are removed, then engineered in a lab to better recognize cancer, and then return to the body to attack the tumor. At this year's ASCO meeting, researchers from the University of Pennsylvania presented results from a trial in glioblastoma patients. Their CAR T cells were designed to target two proteins often found in these tumors. These are known as EGFR and IL-13R-alpha-2. These CAR T cells were delivered directly into the spinal fluid. Results were impressive. Over 60% of patients had tumor shrinkage. Even more encouraging, some patients had long-lasting responses with CAR T cells still active a year later. Side effects like fever and short-term brain swelling were manageable, and researchers are already working on improving the therapy by adding a third agent and testing it in newly diagnosed patients. At Massachusetts General Hospital, another CAR T-cell trial is underway using a slightly different approach. These CAR T-cells not only target the tumor, but also release small antibody fragments to recruit other immune cells, thereby increasing the chance of a more complete attack. Why is this important? Because glioblastoma is not one uniform tumor. It's a mix of different cell types. Attacking from multiple angles helps reduce the chance that the cancer finds a way to escape. Another therapy presented at ASCO was a drug called Lucerceptin, also known as ST-101. This is a small molecule that reprograms dysfunctional immune cells in the tumor to resume fighting the cancer. In clinical trials, this reprogramming was linked to longer survival, and importantly, it was well tolerated. That means the immune system can be activated without adding a heavy burden of side effects. Okay, what about people whose brain tumors didn't start in the brain? When cancers like lung cancer or breast cancer spread to the brain, they become essentially hard to treat. And these are what we know as brain metastases. There's progress here too. One new therapy called HER3-DXd is an antibody-drug conjugate. Think of it as a smart missile that delivers chemotherapy directly to cancer cells. In patients with brain metastases, this drug led to tumor shrinkage in 30% of lung cancer cases and 23% of breast cancer patients. Even patients with leptomeningeal disease, a particularly challenging condition, saw improvement in survival. This is a big step forward. And for patients with brain metastases from rarer tumors, combinations like Opdivo and Yervoy, which are two immune checkpoint inhibitors, showed promise. Not only did they shrink tumors, they helped preserve neurologic function. That is the ability to think, speak, move, and enjoy daily life. Another update came from the CATNON trial, which is studied how best to use a common chemotherapy drug known as Temodor or temozolomide in patients with grade 3 gliomas. This trial found that delaying chemotherapy until after radiation instead of giving both at the same time led to better outcomes and fewer side effects. That means a gentler yet effective treatment plan for some patients. So what does that mean for you? It means that there's been real tangible progress, not just in labs, but in treatments that may improve survival, reduce suffering, and help people live better, longer lives. It also means that clinical trials are more important than ever. Many of these breakthroughs, CAR T cells, targeted peptides, antibody drug conjugates, are still being tested. That doesn't mean they're unavailable. Many trials are open at academic hospitals and sometimes even in community centers. Patients should feel empowered to ask their doctors about trial options. These are not only for end-stage disease. In some cases, early participation can provide the most benefit. I want to shift a little bit to a different but equally important part of your care, and that is quality of life. Let's be honest, cancer treatment is hard. Surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, immunotherapy, they all come with physical and emotional challenges. Fatigue, pain, nausea, brain fog, fear, frustration, and sadness. But here's the truth. You're more than your diagnosis. You're still a parent, a friend, a neighbor, a dreamer. That identity matters. Quality of life isn't about pretending everything's fine. It's about making space for the things that bring you joy, even during treatment. A walk in the park, a favorite song, the laughter of someone you love. These small moments can be powerful acts of both healing and hope. Speak up about side effects. Tell your doctors how you're feeling, physically and emotionally. There are treatments to help, and don't overlook palliative care. It's not just for end of life. It's for helping you live more comfortable, but more comfortably at any stage of your treatment. You can take steps to feel more in control. Find a doctor who specializes in brain tumors. Use a notebook or smartphone to track symptoms and questions between visits. Stay connected with your primary care doctor. Make sure all parts of your health are coordinated. Join support groups. Talk to people who truly get it. Sharing your story can be healing for you and for others. And pursue the activities that support your wellness. Physical activity, even gentle movement, can boost your mood and energy. Mental engagement through hobbies, books, art, or conversation. Connection with friends, family, community. And nutrition, sleep, and rest. These are fundamental building blocks of healing. Just because you've been diagnosed with a brain tumor doesn't mean you can't enjoy life. You can still go to the mall, laugh in a movie, savor your favorite meal, or celebrate your birthday. Life doesn't mean stopping with a diagnosis, and every joyful moment is a powerful response to illness. Hope doesn't always mean a cure. It can mean hope for time, hope for clarity, hope for peace, hope for a good day. Even when life isn't what you imagined it, it can still hold meaning, connection, and beauty. Sometimes facing cancer brings a new appreciation for the present, a renewed sense of purpose, deeper relationships. To those of you living with brain tumors, You're brave not because you chose this path, but because you continue to show up every day. Your story, your resilience drives everyone forward. You're the reason researchers keep on working. You're not forgotten. We also need to acknowledge the loved ones, the caregivers and advocates who are walking this journey alongside you. Your presence matters. Your support, your strength, your sacrifices, they're a vital part of this fight. Thank you for all you do. Know that the medical community sees you and values you. So let me offer some closing thoughts. The ASCO meeting made one thing clear. The future of brain tumor care will be smarter, more personalized, and more compassionate. Immunotherapy, precision drugs, and cell therapies are being tailored to your specific tumor and to your life. Equally important is the growing recognition of the patient voice in research and care. More clinical trials are now including patient-reported outcomes, asking patients directly how treatment affects their symptoms, their energy, and their ability to enjoy life. This shift helps ensure that what matters most to patients, not just survival, but well-being, is front and center in treatment development. Let me take a moment to emphasize how extraordinary this era of cancer research truly is. A decade ago, many of the therapies we're discussing today didn't even exist or were only theories being tested in the lab. Now, patients are living longer, experiencing fewer side effects, and most importantly, living with greater dignity and hope. So thank you for letting me be part of this journey, even for just a few minutes today. Keep reaching out, keep speaking up, and most of all, keep living in whatever way that means for you. Thank you. I'll hand this back over to Carolyn now.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Bruce. That was just so very inspiring. And, well, first of all, lots of information here, but also just very inspiring what you said about living each day, going to a mall, enjoying those moments with family and friends. So I hope everyone will tuck that away, remember it, and actually and use that as an inspiration for each of you. Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce, and just a wonderful presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin, and Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin will be addressing prostate cancer updates from ASCO and doctor-patient communication from ASCO. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Slovin.
Thank you so much, Dr. Mesner, and welcome everyone. It's always a challenge to try to talk about everything that goes on in the world of prostate cancer, and it's always my pleasure to try to update everybody on the call. Some information may be relevant to many of you. Others may find that it's not exactly directed toward the current stage of your cancer. However, I think knowledge is always power, and therefore the one theme that I think you can, or we do actually take away from ASCO, is that we as the physicians always want to do better for the patient, whether that means a new therapy or taking an older therapy, repurposing it, or doing something to enhance its effectiveness. That's all part of what we enjoy doing. I'd like to just take 1 minute essentially just to talk about communications. There were several talks at ASCO this year that is really focused on improving physician-patient communication. It really focuses on how to better explain what we're doing, how to reach patients with greater clarity, and more importantly, to try to provide information in a manner that is more easily digested by the patient and his or her family, so to speak. And this goes across international lines as well. And, you know, how do we, you know, what should we as physicians be doing, whether it's body language? Should we be sitting? Should we be standing? Should we be giving out information? The point is that patients often are on information overload. And while, just like today, we are all talking to you about different solid tumors and treatments, nevertheless, you're not in the field, and we we try very, very hard to put the information into a context where it is digestible and understandable by all of the people with whom we deal. So I would say that please be advised that we continue as physicians to try to improve how we perform for you. So the themes for ASCO for solid tumors, whether it's prostate, which is what I focus on, or others, it's really, can we personalize it and can we intensify it? So can we make the treatment much more relevant to a patient, or is there a way to take existing therapies and improve them markedly? So really identifying features that are common to different groups of people. If they have a genetic alteration, can we put them in one group and try to find a treatment that works the best for them? And so trying to develop specific therapies based on what we often will call risk factors. Now, the risk doesn't mean risk of death. It just means that the patient's cancer may be a little bit more aggressive and have certain features that are shared by other patients. And therefore, can we focus on this group of patients as being unique enough that we spend time and effort to develop treatments that will be used for this common abnormality or mutation or something that is unique to that group? So there are several significant updates in prostate cancer treatment and management that emerged from ASCO. And I guess the best one to start out with really is based on genomic profiling. So as many of you know, if you have a family history of prostate cancer or you have metastatic prostate cancer at diagnosis or have high-risk features based on looking under the microscope, something known as cribriform or acinar or intraductal features, it just refers to how your pathology looks under the microscope. They are risk factors and they are important for us to know so that we can try to treat the cancer appropriately. So many of you already know that we want genomic profiling. We think this is very important because it tells us, number one, is there a mutation in your prostate that would make not only you, but your offspring susceptible to cancer. And the most important one that everybody knows about, I'm sure, is what we call BRCA1 and BRCA2, which is breast cancer 1, breast cancer 2. And those are mutations in a gene that predisposes patients to not only breast cancer in terms of BRCA1, but in the BRCA2 or BRCA2, it's prostate cancer. And about 40% of men have this mutation. Now, if it's what we call a germline mutation, that means it is passed on to your son or daughter or both. If it is somatic, it means it's a mutation that is unique to the tumor itself, but it is not passed on to your children. So when we meet people or people come in the middle of treatment, want new advice, knowing the BRCA status, whether it's germline, meaning passed on to your offspring, or somatic, meaning it's unique just to the tumor, is really important as to how we would prognosticate how to give the best treatment. So we have been very fortunate over the last several years, not only in prostate, but in other cancers such as endometrial or ovarian cancers, to have the approval of at least four different drugs, what we call PARP inhibitors. Now, PARP inhibitors are a class of drugs standing for phosphoadenosyl riboside phosphatase. It is a group, or I should say PARP is itself a molecule, if you will, it's an enzyme or chemical within the cell whose job is to repair any abnormality in DNA. DNA is broken in your cell, that it's supposed to take it up and sew it back to where it is normal. The problem is, if it's a cancer cell, the last thing we want is for that cancer cell to survive. Hence, a PARP inhibitor is a drug that stops that sewing, if you will, back of the double strand of DNA so that the cell lives. So we have four PARP inhibitors, rucaparib, niraparib, olaparib, talazoparib, and I could, forgive me, but you know, a lot of these could be very easily discussed with your doctors. But just know that the PARP inhibitors have all been FDA approved for use in prostate cancer. And the reason that they have slight differences is their ability to bind to DNA, number one, and number two, their approval in for certain mutations in prostate cancer. So olaparib can be used for BRCA1 and BRCA2, but also for ATM, PALB mutation, a variety of different mutations, whereas rucaparib might be a lot more narrow in its spectrum of coverage. So what's that got to do with anything in the world of ASCO? Well, we had some highlights on the Amplitude trial that actually showed improved outcomes using the PARP inhibitor niraparib plus a standard of care drug. I mean, they're both standards of care, but the combination is unusual. The standard of care niraparib is used in combination with abiraterone, and this was for patients who had metastatic but castration-sensitive prostate cancer. In other words, you didn't have resistant disease. This is brand new. And one of the benefits of this was that for the first time, there was really a reduction in the what we call radiographic progression. So it affected not only how fast your cancer was progressing in bone, for example, but also had improvement in a variety of other features. So the idea is, I mean, if you compare this to placebo plus abiraterone and using niraparib plus abiraterone, it was very clear that there was a potential benefit of using niraparib with abiraterone, particularly in those patients who have these genomic alterations, what we call homologous repair deficiencies. So that is an ongoing follow-up, and I mean, there's already been some approvals in the castration-resistant state of using some of these drugs in combination with other standard of care drugs such as enzalutamide. Now, what else is new? Well, all of you, I'm sure by now, if you're watching television, you're hearing about Pluvicto or lutetium-177 PSMA, prostate-specific membrane antigen. This is what we call a radioligand therapy, and it works by having a small molecule, if you want to call it that, because it is small, but it's hooked up to a radioactive compound, what we call a beta emitter, which has good penetration, known as lutetium. Well, what happens is this little molecule runs around the body and looks for sites that express, cancer cells, I should say, that expresses PSMA on its surface. It will quickly bind, and what happens is that it itself, in addition to binding to PSMA, remember, it's also bound to some radioactivity. The cancer cell is very smart. It starts to envelop it and take it into the interior of its body, if you will, where there is a organelle in the cancer cell called a lysosome. And what it does, it breaks off that little small molecule from the radioactive portion, and once the radioactivity is released, it breaks the cancer cell. And we already know that it is a standard of care, but we also want to try to optimize it. So as a single agent, it's great. It's shown improvement in, you know, disease control and even survival. But now what people are trying to do is combine it with other therapies, such as chemotherapies, checkpoint inhibitors, and even more recently, chemotherapy, and even the possibility of CAR T cells. So there were several abstracts that suggest that there may be some advantage, but if they're not without some side effects. So that has to be kept in mind. Another radio, as we call it, radio tracer, in other words, radioactive molecule that can be hooked up to PSMA, is actinium. And there were some studies that showed that actinium-225, and that's in clinical trials, has actually been very helpful in treating patients. It's just that at this time, we don't know where the benefit is in its totality. Is it in patients with metastatic castration metastatic castration sensitive or castration resistant prostate cancer. So these trials are ongoing, but there is definitely a blush of excitement that we are doing something that's advantageous to the patient. What about trying to nip the disease in the bud, so to speak, before it even gets out there? Well, there was a phase 1/2 study of a molecule called terbium, T-E-R-B-I-U-M, 161. It's a novel radionuclide that seemed to be able to detect micrometastases. Now, this is fabulous. I mean, we don't have the final results, obviously, but what's fabulous about it is the fact that if somebody has a PSA that's rising and we don't see anything on imaging, we really, really want to know where are those cells hiding and who has disease that's starting to evolve in spite of a rising PSA but negative scan. So this is in also a development phase. We were all very surprised at ASCO about a phase 3 trial that was reported. It was called CAN, C-A-N, which stands for Candel Therapeutics, and it was CAN-2409, which was an experimental, what we call oncolytic, in other words, it breaks DNA, viral immunotherapy. And it was a modified adenovirus, which means it really wouldn't hurt the patient, but it delivered a enzyme that is, or chemical that's associated with the herpes simplex virus. And so this was given into the prostate directly by just a needle. And what it did was trigger some cancer cell death and indicated in the data that it had an immune response against the tumor. It is being evaluated in prostate cancer. It is not FDA approved, and it is unlikely to be for every patient, but it's also being looked at in non-small cell lung cancer and pancreatic cancer. So what else is there? Well, there's a lot of different things. There is a drug called tarlatamab, which is being evaluated in patients with neuroendocrine tumor. We are looking at things called AR degraders, AR standing for antigen receptors, and there are drugs that actually breaks down that particular molecule on the tumor cell so that the tumor cell does not continue to be stimulated. A lot of new things that are coming down the pike, what I neglected to mention is using Pluvicto before chemotherapy. It was approved after, but now it may be part of a first-line armamentarium for patients who have newly diagnosed metastatic disease. In that setting, we have disease-controlling elements, meaning more treatments than we possibly know what to use, including combinations of chemotherapy with some of the androgen receptor signaling inhibitors and hormonal therapies. So, lots more to come. We're interested in knowing how to pick patients and find the right therapy for them, whether it's genomically or other risk factors that look at certain genes that are in their tumor or in their bloodstream. So more to come. Please be optimistic, because I certainly am, and hopefully by next year we'll have even more exciting information for you. So with that, thank you so much for your attention, and back to you, Carolyn.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Slovin. That was just a superb presentation on really updates from ASCO on prostate cancer and also the doctor-patient communication issue. And I just want to thank you for all the detail that you provided for our patients and on the call today, their family and caregivers. I can't thank you enough for just a superb presentation. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Christoph Misikowicz. And Dr. Misikowicz is Associate Professor of Medicine, Hematology and Medical Oncology, ICANN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, Clinical Director of Research in Head and Neck, Clinical Director of the Center for Personalized Cancer Therapies, CPCT, the Tisch Cancer Institute, Chairman of the Oncology Pharmacy and Therapeutics Committee. And Dr. Misikowicz will be addressing head and neck cancer updates from ASCO and prevention and management of treatment side effects from ASCO. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Misikowicz.
So hello, everybody. I hope that this meeting is very informative. I kind of have been part of the journey for quite a bit. So I see the evolution and as more and more treatments are being introduced so we can use as we treat our cancer. So I'm going to focus on the head and neck cancer. And first, I just want to use some kind of a metaphoric explanation that is going to be a foundation of the future trials that I'm going to just cover as an ASCO update. So, and the reason that I'm doing this is because I think we are, no matter what our educational background is, sometimes we're kind of getting lost in this, what I call it, a medical mumbo jumbo. And this language that sometimes is even foreign to us. It's going to be quite obvious as I'm going to try to pronounce some of those medications' names. So I want to start, and I think this metaphor can be used in many cancers, that cancer is like a weed in the garden. So basically, when you're going to think about the weed in the garden, what you're trying to get, you get the shovel, you kind of dig it out, but you know that you have to get all the roots. And you know what's going to happen if one of those roots is going to stay behind, and you're kind of using your eyes to make sure that you got them all. That's the first aspect. The second aspect is that the same weed in the garden, you know that it can drop some spores or seeds, and some of them can be carried by the wind. And we don't know if it's 1, 10, 20, and can be carried to the other parts of the garden. And unfortunately, if I'm going to give you the magnifying glass and I'm going to ask you to find those seeds or spores in your garden and the grass, you're not going to be able to find them because they're kind of too small to be detected. So many times as we treating the cancer, and what we think about surgeons, not because they're blind or they have bad eyes or because of the intention, they try their best, knowing the limitations that I just presented, to make sure that the entire cancer was removed, and not 99, not 95, not 99.9. You want to remove the entire cancer to make sure there is no leftovers, as I call it, and making sure that obviously you don't have to do anything after. Many times as the patients are waiting for the surgery or they require the surgery, they have to wait because they need the cardiac clearance, because they have to schedule the operating suite. And many times it's about 5 to 6 weeks. And basically during this time, patient is waiting and nothing is happening because it was current standard of care. You just wait for the surgery until it happens. So, and this is not the ask when I'm going to present, but I'm going to just expand on this. What recently was done in head and neck, we realized that as you're waiting, you can get immunotherapy. So there's some kind of a form of the treatment that can be introduced prior to surgery that is doing something to help you. And immunotherapy has several purposes as is given prior to surgery. One purpose is to shrink the cancer, so you can imagine the surgery is easier. The second, what you're trying to do, because cancer is like a spy in your body, it becomes invisible. It's kind of putting the fake moustache metaphorically and trying to be invisible, so the immune system is not doing anything to kind of attack it. Metaphorically, the purpose of the immunotherapy is to unmask. So basically, your immune system can identify the spy or villain, whatever you want to call it, in your body and try to attack. So the first purpose is to shrink the cancer. The second purpose, what it is, that if your immune system is going to know exactly how the cancer looks like, it will create the memory cells. I kind of tell my patients sometimes, it's sort of like if you work in the bank and I'm going to give you the photograph of the somebody who's going to rob the bank, and I'm going to tell you, if you're going to see this person, call 911, you're going to remember for the rest of life, and it's going to be in your picture kind of panel. We're trying to kind of do the same thing with the immune system. We're trying to teach the immune system to kind of learn how the cancer can look like and eventually act upon. So there is this biological mechanism that we hope that as the surgery is being done, and if God forbid, if there is any leftovers after, that maybe those leftovers are going to be eliminated by immunotherapy, and maybe your body is going to have this knowledge how the cancer looks like, so eventually maybe I can act upon this. So the study that was done, and it was not at ASCO, but recently, actually within the last 3 months, it was approved by the FDA, that we give immunotherapy prior to surgery. This is number one. What was presented at ASCO, because as you give immunotherapy and you're trying to shrink the cancer and you're trying to teach the human body how to recognize the cancer, the way we evaluate as we do the surgery, we evaluate the effectiveness of this treatment by removing, and the pathologists, they look under the microscope and they say, what is the proportion of the cancer that was surgically removed is dead? So basically, you're trying to kill as much of the cancer as possible, and it can be 60-40, 70-30, 90-10. The proportions, those are the random numbers that I'm giving you. And there is something called major pathological response, meaning that if the 90% of the cancer is dead and only 10% of the specimen is live, we call it the major pathological response. So the current standard offers with the immunotherapy that about 15% of the patients are going to have major pathological response. The cancer still can be removed, but obviously we're not satisfied with those numbers. So what was presented at ASCO, and this is sort of like the our doctor's greed, as I can call it, that we're asking ourselves, can we improve this proportion of the cancer that's going to be regardless removed to be dead? And what they did, they combined chemotherapy and immunotherapy, and this number almost sometimes quadruple or sometimes it's five times higher. So basically by adding chemotherapy to immunotherapy, I kind of say sometimes one plus one doesn't make you two, it gives you five. It's a synergistic effect. And there are at least two abstracts that were presented showing promising results that if you're going to do prior surgery for anybody who has aggressive cancer, instead of immunotherapy, you're going to combine it with the old-fashioned chemotherapy, so the new medication doesn't have to be invented. It's more like a secret recipe. You can improve those numbers. And what is the benefit of this? That, as you can imagine, I'm going to give you the imaginary patient. If let's say we give surgery, and the patients after the surgery tell them that unfortunately we kill 99% of the cancer, there is still some leftovers, we would have to do radiation or chemotherapy and radiation after. And if we can increase this proportion or chance that after the surgery, we're going to say, no, we think we killed it all, there is no cleaning or there is no other intervention that has to happen after. And basically the ASCO showed this trend in quite a few abstracts that maybe this is the way to go. And this is just one of example because I said that immunotherapy was combined with chemotherapy. But I'm just hoping maybe next year in 2 years I'm going to tell you there is a new drug, different combination, different cocktail, and maybe those numbers are going to go up. And there is no limits because the new medications are being invented. And I encourage you, just giving you those numbers, to participate in clinical trials because you can be part of the amazing journey and increase the chance of this cancer being killed completely. So the first thing I want to say, obviously, about this amazing result of combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy. Some things that was discussed today, and I like to use my metaphors, I said at some point, and probably it's going to be implemented as we treat our cancer. Metaphorically, I said that the weed can produce the spores and some of them can be carried by the wind. We kind of can measure them, how many of them you have in the blood. And it's a metaphoric explanation, it's quite a stretch. But it's called circulating DNA. So basically you can imagine we have this extra layer of tests that we're learning. And many times they're not FDA approved or they're not used as a standard of care. But it's an extra layer of tests to tell us that if the surgery was successful as we speak to the surgeon, as we speak to the patient and the pathologist and we say that the patient had a complete pathological response, meaning the entire cancer was dead, and then we have this extra layer of the circulating DNA and it also is going to be zero, it kind of increases the chance that maybe you are cured from the cancer and there is no other intervention that has to be done after. So that's the first part that I want to discuss. The second part of the ASCO I want to discuss and move to the recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancer. So basically, recurrent metastatic head and neck cancer, it's unfortunately many times an incurable disease. And what we're trying to achieve a shrinkage of the cancer or trying to put the cancer to sleep and make patients live longer with the minimal toxicity and a good quality of life. So kind of not interfere with your life, but at the same time give you the treatment that obviously is going to make you live longer. So historically, what we use in head and neck cancer, we use chemotherapy and immunotherapy, or we use immunotherapy. And the challenges of those two approaches, that the immunotherapy, even though it's non-toxic or minimally toxic given alone, has a modest response. We're not happy with this, so we want better responses. So this is number one. The second one, for the patient for which we give chemotherapy and immunotherapy, we don't like the chemotherapy piece because for a good reason, actually valid reason, chemotherapy has the fame of causing toxicity. And yes, it is true. The chemotherapy can be toxic. So the current effort is what can be added to the immunotherapy, but it's not chemo, that kind of give us good results, because maybe it's going to be better than chemo and immunotherapy, and at the same time, it's not going to give us more side effects. And yes, and actually, there are two companies, there are two studies and two drugs. I'm going to try to pronounce them. First one is Ficerafusp, and the second, Petosemtamab. And basically what it is, the first drug, basically what it is, as we're giving immunotherapy to our patients, we want to make sure that the immunotherapy is going to reach the target. So it's sort of like, sometimes they say, if you're in the boxing set, you want to make sure that your punches are going to reach your opponent. If you're going to be standing far away, you can be throwing your punches left and right, but it's not going to do anything to your opponent, which is a cancer. You have to be close enough. So the first drug, basically what it does, it changes the microenvironment. So actually, all this arsenal of immunotherapy that we use with the drugs that are currently on the market, we want to make sure they're going to reach the target, which sometimes can be challenging. So actually, the first drug that I mentioned, Ficerafusp, what it does, it changes the microenvironment, but it's also, there is a second piece, is also immunotherapy. So there is no chemotherapy component. So basically, this drug was given with the current immunotherapy that we use called pembrolizumab as a combination, so two drugs, and basically showed promising result that it's better than the current standard on the small study. So we cannot use it yet. We have to prove it on the large scale phase 3 clinical study, but it looks very promising, and it's very exciting because A, it seems to be more effective, and B, seems to be less toxic than the current. So I think it's a winner. The second drug, petosemtamab, has a slightly different mechanism of action. So basically, instead of chemotherapy, we're kind of giving two immunotherapy agents, right? So we kind of make it stronger. And also, we see the kind of the same paradigm, that the results are better. There is more responses, and it was done on the smaller study, but both they look promising. And both of them, and I'm going to encourage you, actually both companies, Marius and Bicara, they're opening or open many clinical sites because they want to test this drug. So have this drug approved, and the hope is that one of them or two of them are going to be approved in 2028. So if you have anybody who has a recurrent metastatic cancer and they need promising treatment, I encourage you to participate on those trials or any other trial that is available, because there are many trials that are as promising as the ones that I mentioned. In terms of the reduction of the side effect, we kind of do it not intentionally, because what I just said, that chemotherapy that was, it is toxic, is being replaced by new, more innovative drugs. Some of them to change microenvironment, some of them are immunotherapy. And they kind of subject the patient to less side effects. So I would say that I'm very excited as we're moving forward with the treatment, not only we developing, and obviously I'm just a small piece of this journey, we're developing new drugs that are more effective. We're also developing and putting the drugs in the market that are significantly less toxic than the one that we had. So those are my updates about ASCO. And at the end, I'm going to say there are many clinical trials that you're going to hear today about, and I think you should strongly consider participating in them if there is a need, or eventually recommend to your friends, because otherwise we cannot move science forward. And you have a chance to get a treatment that is very cutting edge, innovative, and maybe it's going to give you better results. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Masikowicz. That was just a superb presentation, and actually just on head and neck cancer, but also on the prevention and management of treatment side effects from ASCO as well. And I hope people will take this away. Also, I just want everyone on the call to know that these programs are occurring today in real time, but will also be available on our website, the Cancer Care website, in about 10 days, and there'll be closed caption for those of you who appreciate that as well. So, okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Masikowicz. And our next speaker is Dr. Dana Chase, and Dr. Chase is Professor and Fellowship Program Director, Division of Gynecologic Oncology, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology, David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. And Dr. Chase will be addressing ovarian cancer updates from ASCO and pain management updates from ASCO. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chase.
Thank you so much. I am really happy to be here to talk to you about some updates that we heard at ASCO about ovarian cancer, as well as a couple related to pain management, not necessarily or really not related to ovarian cancer, but could also be used in ovarian cancer patients. So there's four studies that I want to highlight, and they're each important for different reasons. The first study is called the TRUST trial. And for ovarian cancer patients that are newly diagnosed that have metastatic disease, one of the most, meaning disease that's spread outside of the ovary, one of the most challenging decisions is sometimes whether or not to take that patient for surgery, meaning we have two options for that patient. We can treat them with chemotherapy first, which is called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, or we can do surgery first and follow that surgery with chemotherapy, and that's called adjuvant chemotherapy. And so we've, over the years, done many studies to determine if one approach is better than the other, meaning is it better to take the patient for surgery first, or is it better to take the patient for chemotherapy first and do surgery later. And so this study mostly was done not in the United States, although there was one site in the United States that was at Memorial Sloan Kettering in New York City. And in this study, their main objective was to show a difference in terms of outcomes in patients that had surgery first. But unfortunately, they did not show a benefit in terms of patients living longer if they got surgery first, meaning if you get chemotherapy first versus if you get surgery first, the outcomes of the treatment look similar. And so that was the biggest take-home message. And actually, I think it helps to know that if you're a patient and you're going to get chemotherapy first, to not have the thought, oh, that's because I'm going to do worse than if the doctor decided to do the surgery first. So actually, if you have chemotherapy first and surgery later, you have less complications, less chance of having a colostomy bag, for example, less hospital stay. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're not as well or you're not going to do as well if you have chemotherapy first as opposed to surgery. Of course, if your doctor thinks that you're healthy enough and that your cancer is in a situation where that doctor thinks, that surgeon thinks they can get all the cancer out at surgery, perhaps that's a better option for you to have surgery first. But that decision has to be made very, very carefully. And if you're not able to have surgery first, I wouldn't worry too much about your outcomes, meaning it could be that you would do just as well if you had surgery first versus if you have to have chemo first. So that was called the TRUST trial. The next study I want to highlight is a study called the FIRST trial. And this also is a trial that was done in patients with newly diagnosed stage 3 or 4 ovarian cancer. And this study looked at adding an immunotherapy agent called a checkpoint inhibitor to a PARP inhibitor, which is a pill. So the immunotherapy is given in the IV. A PARP inhibitor is a pill with or without an IV treatment called bevacizumab in maintenance. So that means all patients get chemotherapy first after surgery or before surgery and then after surgery. And then after the chemotherapy is done, this is looking at adding an immunotherapy to a PARP inhibitor with or without bevacizumab. And unfortunately, in ovarian cancer, we just haven't seen a benefit to adding in immunotherapy to our standard of care maintenance treatment. So unfortunately, it really didn't seem like immunotherapy was going to raise the bar in terms of outcomes in ovarian cancer patients. So this is not really that surprising because really immunotherapy in an ovarian cancer patient just in general has been pretty disappointing in terms of improving outcomes. So there was maybe a month or two of an improvement, but really not something that we think is very clinically meaningful. So I think the standard of care for frontline treatment of metastatic ovarian cancer, the standard of care for maintenance remains bevacizumab, which is an IV treatment with or without a PARP inhibitor, which is that pill. So that just remains the standard of care, and I don't think anybody really is going to incorporate immunotherapy into that maintenance approach. Now, the third trial I want to bring up is a trial called the Rosella trial. This is a trial of our highest risk ovarian cancer patient, which is our ovarian cancer patient that has something called platinum-resistant disease. And so platinum-resistant recurrent disease means after platinum-based chemotherapy, like, for example, carboplatin paclitaxel, the patient has a recurrence of their cancer within 6 months of finishing that chemotherapy. And that's always a sad situation for the patient because they just recently finished chemotherapy less than 6 months ago, and now they're having to face going on treatment again. And so this study looked at standard of care treatment, which is just single agent Abraxane, which is a type of a taxol given IV in a weekly dose. It looked at that versus that weekly Abraxane with a drug called relacorilant, which is an oral medication. And essentially that oral medication is thought to make the chemotherapy work better. That's the thought of it, that this oral medication helps the chemotherapy kill cells better. And so actually we did see that this combination, the weekly chemotherapy with the pill called relacorilant, did actually improve outcomes for patients with this platinum-resistant recurrent ovarian cancer. And so that was good news to have a new combination, a new medication that we could use in the platinum-resistant ovarian cancer patient. Now, this is not yet FDA approved, so we actually don't yet have it for patients, but it'll be interesting to see if in the future we have this approval to use in our patients with this platinum-resistant ovarian cancer. And then the final abstract I wanted to mention is a treatment called pembrolizumab with lenvatinib, which is an IV immunotherapy with an oral treatment called lenvatinib for clear cell ovarian cancer. Now, clear cell ovarian cancer is a very rare type of ovarian cancer. We don't see that type very commonly. And if those patients have recurrent or persistent disease after standard of care chemotherapy, it looks like, based on this abstract, that pembrolizumab with lenvatinib had an impressive response rate. So the response rate and also the duration of the response looked impressive for this type of ovarian cancer, which is traditionally very difficult to treat. And so, again, having potentially a new option for those patients is really good news. So I'm hoping to see the publication for that and to maybe have that as an option for my patients with recurrent clear cell ovarian cancer. So I'm just going to finish with a really quick summary of three pain management abstracts. One is a pain management abstract that included a digital pain management app called ePain Support. And it was an NIH-funded randomized controlled trial looking at patients that were on hospice and their caregivers. And basically, patients that were in the intervention group, meaning their caregiver had access to this app, this pain management app, those patients were 2.5 times more likely to have a decrease in their pain than patients in the control group. So it looked like this app that caregivers could use was feasible and could also contribute to improved caregiver knowledge and then reduced pain in hospice patients. So I'm curious again to see how we might be able to use that app in real life with our patients might be really helpful. And then the second pain management abstract I wanted to highlight was a virtual pain reality, a virtual reality intervention for pain and anxiety management actually during bone marrow biopsy. And this was a systematic review. I honestly hadn't heard about this before, but this is a virtual reality tool that can potentially help in a safe way reduce pain during a procedure like a bone marrow biopsy. So I could see how this could be applied to certain procedures in gynecologic oncology, and I'd be curious to read the final publication. Again, a virtual reality intervention for pain during a procedure that could be really helpful. And then the final one is a phase 3 double-blind trial using cannabis extract in pain management to improve quality of life and pain management in patients with metastatic lung cancer. Again, could be applied to our patients with gynecologic cancer. And this is an extract that was administered every 5 days in a certain protocol, which I don't have time to go into here, but it looked like this extract could be considered as an adjuvant in the management of pain and quality of life in patients with metastatic lung cancer. An intervention for pain in a lung cancer patient could be applied potentially to other cancer types. I really enjoyed reading about these pain management abstracts that I wouldn't have necessarily otherwise seen since they're not gynecologic cancer oriented, but certainly something to maybe consider in gynecologic cancer patients as well. And so that concludes my summary of ovarian cancer abstracts and pain management. And thank you so much for allowing me to participate in this call.
Thank you so much, Dr. Chase. That was just a wonderful presentation. Some pain management tools that you identified for our participants. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Priscilla Merriam. And Dr. Merriam is Senior Physician, Medical Oncology, Clinical Director, Sarcoma Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Merriam is going to provide a sarcoma update from ASCO, and she also will do a wrap-up of Part 1 of ASCO 2025. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Merriam.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's an honor to join you and the other speakers to review sarcoma highlights from the 2025 ASCO annual meeting. I always enjoy having the opportunity to try to share some of the insights that we gain and the conversations that we have at this very important meeting, because I know that most people are not able to attend the meeting. So it's a real honor to be able to communicate some of those important insights and data that we learn every year. So there were several studies presented this year in the sarcoma track that used tyrosine kinase inhibitors, which is an oral type of cancer medication, in new settings. The tyrosine kinase inhibitor, enlotinib, was added to a chemotherapy drug called epirubicin in a phase 3 randomized study that compared epirubicin with enlotinib versus epirubicin alone or with placebo in individuals with sarcoma who needed medical therapy who had previously never received any type of medical treatment. This study was conducted in China, where enlotinib is used in a number of different sarcoma clinical trials. Individuals who participated in this study were treated with the chemotherapy epirubicin and either got enlotinib or placebo for a total of 6 cycles. If the sarcoma remained stable during the initial treatment period, individuals could continue on either enlotinib or on placebo based on their original random assignment. There was some suggestion of possible improvement in the group that received epirubicin plus enlotinib, but the results were somewhat difficult to interpret because the results that were seen in the group that had received the chemotherapy and placebo, so did not receive enlotinib, their results seemed a little bit worse than we would have expected based on historical results. And therefore, the results seen in the combination group of epirubicin plus enlotinib might not be as significant as was suggested in the study. The reported results are important, however, because they help us to further understand the potential use and potential tolerability of the combination treatment with chemotherapy and tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Another study was reported that used the combination of the chemotherapy drug eribulin, so a different chemotherapy, plus the tyrosine kinase inhibitor enlotinib. There appeared to be encouraging controls seen with this approach as compared to results reported in the past for enlotinib alone. So this was enlotinib plus chemotherapy, but a different one than I discussed previously. Finally, enlotinib was studied in a randomized phase 3 study of enlotinib versus placebo for people with advanced or metastatic leiomyosarcoma. This was an international study for people who had had their leiomyosarcoma grow on at least one prior treatment, including prior treatment with an anthracycline type of chemotherapy. There appeared to be a mild increase in how long the leiomyosarcoma was controlled for people who were receiving enlotinib, as compared to people who had been randomized to receive placebo. In a group of individuals who had received three or fewer prior treatments for their leiomyosarcoma before starting the study. Hopefully there will be further work in the future to help us understand how this drug might impact the quality of life of people taking it, and when this drug or other similar drugs should be used to provide optimal benefit to individuals. The oral abstract session this year was notable for the number of studies that were presented on unique sarcoma subtypes. As you may know, sarcomas are a group of rare tumors, and there are many types of sarcomas, each of which may behave very differently from one another and may require very different treatment approaches. This point was emphasized by the discussant, Dr. Wagner, who reminded us that rare and ultra-rare sarcomas can and should be studied as distinct entities. In that spirit, results were presented for the phase 3 MANEUVER study. The study was called MANEUVER, of the oral medication pimicotinib for people living with tenosynovial giant cell tumor, or TGCT, which is a soft tissue tumor but is not cancerous. Despite the fact that we call TGCT a benign tumor, it can cause significant symptoms for individuals living with this, resulting in chronic pain or functional impairments, such as difficulty with working or other impacts on quality of life. This was a randomized phase 3 study in which individuals with symptomatic TGCT were randomly assigned to receive either pimicotinib or placebo. Individuals who were receiving pimicotinib had important reductions in the size of their tumors, but of particular importance was the improvement that was seen in symptoms such as pain, stiffness, or other physical function. Importantly, pimicotinib was felt to be well tolerated and did not seem to cause liver issues, as had been seen with some drugs used in the past for treatment of TGCT. A report that was of great interest to many people were results from treatment of individuals with desmoplastic small round cell tumor who received a treatment that had been developed initially for breast cancer. We discussed this earlier. Breast cancer is expressing the HER2 protein called trastuzumab deruxtecan. This is a targeted therapy, also called T-DXd, that is in the class of treatments of drugs, of medications called antibody drug conjugates. Dr. Slotkin presented the results, which were not obtained through a planned clinical trial, but from what was called off-label use of this medication, which the FDA has approved for other uses. Based on some preclinical data, the investigators thought this type of treatment might help individuals with the rare sarcoma subtype of desmoplastic small round cell tumor. Indeed, there were some very encouraging responses presented. One of the challenges for the investigators is that they were not able to find a consistent biomarker or test that they could use to predict if an individual would respond to T-DXd. A formal trial is planned for the use of this drug in a larger study. Another rare sarcoma subtype that was treated with a novel approach is Kaposi sarcoma, a vascular tumor that is caused by infection of endothelial cells by the human herpes virus 8, or HHV-8. This virally mediated cancer can be seen in individuals with HIV infection or without HIV. Kaposi sarcoma that requires medical therapy is sometimes treated with chemotherapy, and new approaches are always under investigation. The team at the National Institutes of Health reported results from a phase 1-2 study of an oral medication, abemaciclib, which is a CDK4/6 inhibitor. Encouragingly, there was a high rate of improvement in Kaposi sarcoma lesions following treatment with abemaciclib. Further studies underway to understand more about the potential benefits of this approach. Finally, results of a phase 2 study of the immunotherapy drug camrelizumab, a and the tyrosine kinase inhibitor apatinib were reported for a trial in individuals with chordoma, a very rare type of bone cancer or bone tumor. Tyrosine kinase inhibitors have been previously studied for individuals with chordoma who require medical therapy. Additionally, there has been some suggestion in prior clinical trials that immunotherapy could potentially play a role for chordomas. There were some promising results seen in terms of some decrease in the chordomas in people participating in the study. This adds to our understanding about chordoma treatment and additional work ahead to further define who may benefit from this type of approach and how this type of treatment may impact or may improve quality of life. The team at Princess Margaret Cancer Center in Toronto, Canada, presented data from a prospective study that they performed collecting circulating tumor DNA, which we also discussed earlier in the call, in patients who had a diagnosis of sarcoma in only one part of the body called localized disease. Testing for circulating tumor DNA has been around in the cancer field for some time. But since the field of sarcoma encompasses so many different types of sarcomas that have different characteristics, data for using this type of technology is more recent in reports at our sarcoma meetings. In the study presented at ASCO this year, the research team used tests that were designed for each individual patient based on a prior biopsy of their tumor to design a detection system for pieces of tumor-specific genetic information that might be present in their blood. The study team drew blood samples at planned time points, including before treatment for localized sarcoma, and then at regular intervals after surgery for sarcoma. There were only 32 participants that they followed in the study with blood draws over time, and the types of sarcomas that participants had included just a handful of subtypes, including myxofibrosarcoma, undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma, different liposarcoma subtypes, and leiomyosarcoma. The technology looking for pieces of genetic material in the blood that was tumor-specific seemed to be able to detect presence of active tumor even before there was evidence of tumor on imaging, and this may be a technology that we learn more about in the future in terms of its ability to help us follow tumor activity for individuals with sarcoma. Overall, there were many more abstracts this year as compared to in recent years, the reported data using this type of technology, and I expect we'll be learning more about these tools and their role specifically for sarcoma in the coming years. The Spanish sarcoma group presented results from their Immunosarc study, which tested the chemotherapy drugs epirubicin and ifosfamide with the immunotherapy drug nivolumab in patients with undifferentiated pleomorphic sarcoma. Participants were planned to receive 6 cycles of the combination treatment and then to continue for a year with the immunotherapy drug nivolumab alone for maintenance. 16 individuals participated in the study, and none of the people participating had ever received a chemotherapy drug in the anthracycline class in the past, which is typically considered one of the more active types of treatment for the sarcoma subtype. The investigators hoped that by giving chemotherapy, this would particularly make tumor cells stimulate immune activity against the cancer when individuals were also receiving the immunotherapy drug nivolumab. The number of people participating in the study was small overall, as this was a phase 1 study testing 2 different doses of nivolumab. Most patients appeared to have some benefit from the treatment, and therefore the study team is looking to conduct additional clinical trials of the combination of chemotherapy plus immunotherapy to learn more about whether this approach may be beneficial for patients. In the rapid oral abstract session, there were reports of 2 phase 1 clinical trials for patients with osteosarcoma. Osteosarcoma that has grown despite standard chemotherapy is a sarcoma type for which we are looking for new approaches. The trials of the agents C019199, an agent that the researchers hope will modify the tumor microenvironment of osteosarcoma cells, and ALMB0168, a targeted therapy against a protein on the surface of osteosarcoma cells that seems important to the growth of the cancer cells, showed some encouraging early results. We look forward to seeing more results from these approaches as further clinical trial data become available. And finally, Dr. Chi presented updated results from the phase 1 study of NB003 in people with advanced gastrointestinal stromal tumor, or GIST. NB003 is an oral agent designed with the goal of treating both primary and secondary drug-resistant mutations for individuals with GIST with mutations in a gene called KIT. Many individuals participating in the study had tumor shrinkage, including people who had previously received several prior types of treatment for their GIST. Notably, responses were seen from tumors with some known drug-resistant mutations that are challenging to treat with other medications. With these results, a larger international phase 3 study is planned to learn more about the potential activity of this agent for people with previously treated advanced gastrointestinal stromal tumor. In the 2025 President's Address, Dr. Robin Zahn emphasized the importance of technology, advocacy, and community in driving advances in cancer care. The roles that technology, advocacy, and community play in the research shared at the 2025 meeting was evident, not just in the sarcoma track, but in the meeting overall. The annual ASCO meeting is, in fact, the ultimate manifestation of the power that a dedicated community of researchers, patients, families, and people who work every day to care for people with cancer can create together. The annual ASCO meeting is unlike any other cancer meeting in its scale, inspiring researchers around the world to continue their work of improving treatments for people with cancer. But all of the exciting new information we share with each other is possible only with the openness of people with cancer who decide to participate in clinical research trials, looking for better treatments for themselves and for people like them. This meeting is a reminder of the critical foundation created by relationships between patients and all of the people working to improve the care of patients of people with cancer. The community created by all of these amazing people is a reason we work every day to learn more about cancer, about treatments for cancer, about the lives and priorities of people living with cancer, so we can work together to make cancer care better and better. Thank you to everyone for the part you play, and make sure you talk with your treatment team to find out about how to participate in clinical research trials if that's something that is of interest to you. Thank you for inviting me to participate in this program. It has been a true privilege.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Miriam. That was just a superb presentation, not only about sarcoma, but also about your wrap-up of part one of the ASCO 2025. So thank you so much for doing this. It's a wonderful presentation. And I think you leave people with just wonderful hope and also the encouragement to participate in clinical trials. And I'm just going to wrap up today's program by just saying a few words about Cancer Care's free national programs and services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization, and we provide a host of services from practical, financial, and co-payment assistance to online support groups. And also, we have a number of these workshops that we do throughout the year, publications, fact sheets. We also have a number of other services, and you can access all of our services by going to the Cancer Care website at www.cancercare.org, or you can call, for those of you in the United States, you can call our helpline at 1-800-813-4673 and speak with one of our oncology social workers Monday through Friday from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation in this remarkable program today. You heard from the best of the best, and there will be a part two for this program, and part two will occur on Tuesday, August 12th, and it'll be a similar format. We'll be just addressing different cancers updates from ASCO. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.